Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Like the company he founded, Jeff Bezos is a lot of things. But let's start with the basics. Hey, Alexa, who is Jeff Bezos?
According to Wikipedia, Jeffrey Preston Bezos is an American internet entrepreneur, businessman, media proprietor, and investor. Bezos is the founder and CEO of the multinational technology company Amazon. With a net worth of more than $200 billion as of April 2021, he is the richest person in the world according to both Forbes and Bloomberg's Billionaires Index.
On Point listeners, this is a first for the program. I have a guest in the studio that's actually an AI. But Brad, does Alexa have the definition of who Jeff Bezos is right?
Well, yes, but Alexa, Meghna, is being a little misleading because Jeff Bezos is Alexa's inventor. The idea for Alexa sprang out of Bezos' mind. He actually sends an email to his executive saying we should invent a voice computer in late 2010, and then he micromanages the thing. So I don't know if Alexa is being deceptive there, or maybe no one told her who her father is.
Okay, well, let's try this one. Hey, Alexa, what do you think of Jeff Bezos?
I'd rate him 5 stars.
Of course you would.
I wonder who programmed that one.
Okay, so you know what I'm going to do? We're having a little fun with this AI, and I'm actually going to unplug it right now, because otherwise Alexa's going to go nuts during this show.
Jeff can listen the old-fashioned way on the radio.
Exactly. And I'm sorry for everyone who has one of these at home, because we're going to be saying Alexa a lot this hour, because it is episode 2 of our series that we're calling Amazon, The Prime Effect, where we're taking a look at how this massive company is changing the way we live, shop, and work. And today, we're going to try and understand Amazon's founder, Jeff Bezos, what makes him tick, who he is, and how he created an innovation-obsessed corporate culture and empire that's really led to Amazon's explosive growth. And as you heard, Brad Stone is back with us. He was with us in episode 1, and he's going to give us insight on who Jeff Bezos is through the story of Alexa. And Brad's brand new book, by the way, is called Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire. He's also author of The Everything Store. So, Brad, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, I want to start with a little drawing that you have at the beginning of the book, which is like a little pen and ink drawing,
a whiteboard drawing.
Yeah, right. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, okay, so I already mentioned that the idea for Alexa comes from Bezos, late 2010, and he is looking for a way to take advantage of Amazon's advantage in the cloud, AWS, this cloud computing service where devices or other companies will, use Amazon's data centers. And at the time, he is also enamored with voice computing. He's a big science fiction fan. You know, he thinks that the future of computing might be a voice. And he is in a conference room with his assistant at the time, a guy named Greg Hart. And they're trying to figure out what Hart's next job is going to be, because he's kind of leaving that chief of staff role. And Bezos asks him to realize this vision of a voice computer. And the two of them sketch out this drawing. And it's a lot like what Alexa became. Bezos identifies, it should have a mute button if people want their privacy, God forbid. And that one of the challenges will be, how do you get it on the wireless network if it doesn't have a keyboard? Because you can't yet talk to it to configure it. So that's in the drawing. And Amazon, they're hard to write a book about. They can be kind of secretive, but they actually gave me this drawing, and it's at the beginning of chapter 1 in the book.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, because when you first look at it, it's very, very rudimentary. But it does have, it's like a little box with the top of it looks a little lifted off. Some scribbles here and there. But as you noted, it's pretty much what Alexa becomes. So here's my first question. Is it fair to say that the idea for this massively successful product just kind of first sprang out from Bezos's head? And how often did something like that happen with Amazon?
It is remarkable because now I've written two books. How often when you do the archaeology on the big ideas at Amazon and you dig down into the various layers, you often get to a crazy idea from Bezos. And sometimes the ideas go nowhere or they flop. And that's the Fire Phone or, you know, other prominent examples. And sometimes they're the big ideas. And yeah, it's this, you know, Bezos seems to have, you know, this magical elixir of, you know, technical insight about what is perhaps not possible today, but could be possible tomorrow. You know, he's very technically savvy. And since he's a science fiction reader and fan, you know, he likes to conjure the ideas that he grew up with or that he enjoys in science fiction.
Well, so let's hear a little bit of how Bezos himself talked about what the problem was that they were trying to solve with the idea of Alexa AI. And here's what he said in an interview with then editor of The Washington Post, also owned by Jeff Bezos, Marty Baron.
Ask the thermostat to, you know, turn the temperature up a couple of degrees and just say, Alexa, please turn the temperature up 2 degrees. Alexa, turn off all the lights. It's a very natural way of interacting in that kind of environment. And previous to Echo and Alexa, the primary way that people had interacted with their home automation systems was with an app on their phone. But it's very inconvenient. If to control your lights, you have to take your phone out, find your phone, open a particular app, find the right screen to control the lights on that app. You might as well go push the button.
So what's interesting to me about this, Brad, is it seems to be in line with Bezos' well-known focus on the customer. It seems to me the most important word in that clip we just played is convenience.
Mm-hmm. You know, we should note, though, that this was broadly a vision that tech companies had for 20 years. I remember going to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas back when that gathering happened in person, and you would go into these booths from Cisco or Intel or Microsoft, and they all had this vision. But what Bezos put his finger on, I think, is that, yeah, you didn't want to have to go through various screens to manipulate your home, to connect it. And also that it had to be casual. If you were going to use your voice, it wasn't pressing a button and talking into your phone. It was going to be the much more technically difficult feat of being able to utter a command across the room and have the device, the Alexa, understand you. That was something, a technology called far-field voice recognition. And when Bezos was conceiving Alexa, that did not yet exist. That was a very difficult problem.
Right. Much more difficult. Because when you think about it, being any distance away from the listening device produces all sorts of acoustic challenges, let alone other sounds coming from the environment that makes it a lot harder for the device to understand what's being said. But so let's take a step back here, because your book is very deeply reported, Brad, and I understand that you were also given access to hundreds of people at Amazon, but not Bezos himself. But still, you got as close as you could.
I tried. Every trick in the journalistic handbook I attempted.
Yeah, but the people you did talk to know him very well. So what would you say? I mean, you called it a magic elixir, but like, what do you think are his, like, sort of his core characteristics and qualities that we see unfolding in the story of Alexa? And where did those qualities come from?
Right. Well, you know, we talked about the ideas. Maybe that's even the easiest part. But it is the detailed focus and follow up. And so he puts Greg Hart, his technical assistant, his chief of staff at the time, in charge of the project. But then he starts meeting with them once a week, twice a week. He micromanages the selection of Alexa's voice, and that's a voice actress who I identified in the book, a voice actress named Nina Rowley. He selects the name Alexa and determines that there should be a second name for the device, which they, at the last minute, call the Echo. He's also... The other attribute, I think, is the incredible impatience and stubbornness and high standards. These are not necessarily good adjectives, but I have a scene in the book where he basically challenges his voice engineers about how smart Alexa is becoming and why it's taking so long. And he determines that it's going to take years for them to catch up to, say, Google, and he stands up and walks out. He says, "You guys aren't taking this seriously." And, you know, where does that come from? I mean, that's, you know, that is the maybe the technology titan template, right? The impatience that we saw with Steve Jobs or, you know, others, and it makes him difficult to work for, but it also clearly in some respects at Amazon produces results.
Well, the results come because he's surrounded by people who believe in his vision and are willing to basically work themselves to the bone. And also they have the money and the ability to expand, right? Because you write about how quickly the Alexa team gets built up and how much money they put into it as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. Willingness to invest, willingness to like take a big risk, that's another asset that he has. But then also all the other tools, all the other pieces of the Amazon empire. So Alexa doesn't happen without the cloud service, right? Alexa's brains are in AWS. You can buy an Alexa and it sits in your home for 2 years. And every day it could be getting more powerful because Amazon and its data centers is, you know, building better computers and upgrading the equipment. And again, that was part of the origin idea of Alexa. And, you know, Bezos says, we don't have many big advantages. We like to weave a rope of smaller advantages. And that's what he's doing, you know, here with his device business. He's kind of taking all the tools that Amazon has, the retail business, the cloud business, and trying to produce something unique for Amazon's customers.
So weave a web of smaller advantages. And then at the same time, though, as you report, the Alexa project really takes on an ethos that was part of Amazon's earliest days in the late 90s about growing big fast as well.
Right. Yeah. So Bezos says to Greg Hart, the guy who's in charge of Alexa, he basically says he gives him an unlimited budget to go hire talented voice engineers and computer scientists, which is incredible when you think about it. Anyone who's qualified, we need to hire. And they acquire three small companies. So that's another thing. He gave the people in charge a budget. He said, go do it. He wanted it in 6 months. It happened in 4 years. But it probably doesn't happen like that at another tech company.
Right. 4 years versus the 40 years that they originally thought it might take. Well, today it's episode 2 of our series, Amazon, the Prime Effect. And we're trying to understand what makes Amazon founder Jeff Bezos tick. Brad Stone is with us. His new book is Amazon Unbound. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today it's episode 2 of our series taking a look at Amazon. We're calling the series The Prime Effect. And today we're trying to understand what makes Amazon founder Jeff Bezos tick. And I'm joined today by Brad Stone. He's senior executive editor at Bloomberg Technology, has written 2 terrific books on Amazon. The latest, just out, is called Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire. And by the way, we are focusing on the story of Amazon's creation of Alexa AI and what that tells us about who Jeff Bezos is. And Brad, you'll be entertained. We asked listeners to send us stories about their interactions with Alexa, and we got a lot of them that had to do with relationships and love. For example, Michelle Singletary from The Washington Post, a frequent guest here on the show, she said she asked Alexa if her husband loved her. And Alexa said, I'm sure you're very lovable. And her husband said, oh, for goodness sakes. Well, that was just one, one of the relationship questions that Alexa got. Here's another one that came from On Point listener Jamie, who listens from Swansboro, North Carolina. And Jamie told us how Alexa actually insinuated itself. I refuse to call it a her. Insinuated itself between Jamie and her then new boyfriend.
We had told each other that we loved each other. And then he didn't say it again for a couple weeks, which was not a big deal until I was reviewing my Alexa history. And I saw that he had told the AI he loved her probably 50 or 60 times since he had told me once. So we had a good laugh about that, and we are still together, still happy, and still both love our Alexa.
Jamie had me worried there for a while, but still together and still happy. Here's on point.
Was he practicing? What was he doing?
I don't know. It just I don't know. But like 50 or 60 times with Alexa, it's straight out of the movie Her. But this is On Point listener Tom Young, who lives in Rhode Island, who tried to push Alexa's capabilities, the one in his in-laws' house, to its limits.
I would get a kick out of whenever visiting them, asking the Alexa to commence self-destruct sequence. First few times it said it didn't understand the request, but then I think the third or fourth time that I did that, it said, all right, commencing self-destruct sequence, but only on the condition that you dramatically cancel at the last moment. So that was really interesting to me because it showed that Alexa has a learning capability and it was able to eventually recognize her request and have a creative response to it.
Now, Brad, the reason why I wanted to play that one for you is because you write in the book how people on the Alexa project really wanted to focus on music, that it was like a really smart music player. But you write that Jeff Bezos would not let go of the idea of it being a more sophisticated, generalized computer. Can you talk about that?
That's right. You know, we talked about this, his science fiction fandom, the origins in the books and the movies that he loves. And he wanted this thing to be conversational. And I have a funny anecdote in the book where he's testing one in his home. And he's doing what your listeners are describing, kind of interrogating Alexa. That seems to be one of the big applications for Alexa, just to kind of seeing what it does. And Bezos says, he gets frustrated and he says, Alexa, go shoot yourself in the head. And the engineers on the project are terrified because they all think they're going to lose their jobs. But in those meetings, Bezos wanted this thing to be a personal assistant. Among the names that he was contemplating for this thing was Samantha from Bewitched. He really saw it as this personal assistant that would just show up, twinkle its nose, and do everything. And the engineers and marketers were terrified. They knew that when they released this thing, it needed to be practical. So they wanted it to be a music player, and they kind of compromised in the middle.
Oh, they compromised in the middle, but by barely, right? Because it's like the use, right? 51% music player, 49% sophisticated generalized
right.
computer.
And in fact, it's really not conversational in the way that Bezos had hoped. I think in that respect, people have fun with it, but maybe it's a little disappointing. They still have a lot of work to do.
Okay, so we've talked a couple of times about Jeff Bezos' childhood and adult passion for science fiction. And you write in the book about how he sees science fiction as more sort of a template of what can be our future reality. So I'm going to do a pop quiz here for listeners, because we got the answer from your book, Brad, here. But listeners, I want you to guess. We're going to offer you three choices. Which one of these famous sci-fi computers was Jeff Bezos' inspiration for developing Alexa? Was it A?
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Was it B?
Please enter program.
The android at the bar said you could show me my old ship.
Insufficient data. Please specify parameters.
The Enterprise. Show me the bridge of the Enterprise, you chattering piece of...
Or was it C?
Sir, my first job was programming binary load lifters, very similar to your evaporators in most respects.
Can you speak Bocce?
Of course I can, sir. It's like a second language to me. I'm
all right, shut up. I'll take this one.
Shut up, sir.
Luke!
That was just an excuse to play three of my favorite sci-fi computer robots. But Brad, what is the answer?
The answer is B. Bezos is such a big Star Trek fan. I think most people in Silicon Valley kind of are. But yes, he wasn't just talking about and arguing for a versatile an AI. He wanted the Star Trek computer. And in fact, here's a little detail that's not in the book. Over at Google, they had the same idea with Google Voice. And I had once heard that they actually auditioned Major Barrett, the voice of the Star Trek computer, to be the voice of Google Voice. So all these guys seem to be pursuing the Star Trek ideal.
Okay. Well, we've got more about this particular aspect of the story of Alexa. And let's hear first from how Jeff Bezos himself describes it.
Our vision was that in the long term, it would become the Star Trek computer. You could ask it anything and ask it to do things for you, ask it to find things for you, and that it would be easy to converse with in a very natural way.
That's Jeff Bezos in a 2016 interview describing his initial inspiration for Alexa, which began development in 2011. Now, consider the ambition behind that statement. He wanted to develop a computer like the one in Star Trek, a seemingly all-knowing, linguistically sophisticated computer that you could chat with, frustrated, futuristic, Scottish brogue or not. But at that point, a computer that only existed in television fiction.
What was exciting about it is Amazon was stepping into that area without having a long history in that. Like at that time in 2012, if you listed the technology companies that worked in language understanding, I don't think Amazon would have been in the list. My name is Janet Slifka. I'm a director of research science in our Amazon Alexa AI organization.
Janet Slifka had the kind of expertise Bezos needed, a career in speech and acoustics that had already taken her to MIT and speech recognition software companies. She joined Amazon in 2012. The Alexa project was still secret.
It was early. We didn't have anything that worked yet, but lots of enthusiasm to put something together.
Enthusiasm and urgency, because remember, Jeff Bezos wanted to make something like the Star Trek computer. So to make that happen, the product had to be smart, it had to be able to learn, which meant the Alexa team needed a ton of data.
Very challenging from a technical point of view. There are probably more than 1,000 people working on Echo and Alexa.
Data, in this case, meant human speech, people talking.
The notion of what would delight customers would be that you don't have to go find a device and unlock it and bring it up and speak to it, which certainly was the model I had been working on prior to joining. It was this nice big idea about, look, I just want to talk. I just want to speak out into the open air and have things happen. Like that would be magical.
So the team handed out Alexa-enabled prototypes to Amazon employees, including Jeff Bezos, who tested it at his home. It did not go well. As Brad Stone writes in Amazon Unbound, engineers reviewing the data heard their boss get so frustrated by Alexa's lack of comprehension, they can hear Bezos telling the machine, go shoot yourself in the head. But I mean, when you want the Star Trek computer...
There are 14 varieties of tomato soup available from this replicator. Specify hot or chilled.
Hot, plain tomato soup. 14 varieties and they can't even get plain tomato soup right.
But then Janet Slifka came up with an idea. It became known internally as AMPT.
I was very involved in that.
No longer satisfied with employee testing at home, which didn't give them enough data, the Alexa team went into the field.
We would call this in the lingo a supervised data collection.
They rented out different homes and apartments, initially in the Boston area, where they paid a constant stream of random people to come in and read a script.
We can't just use a studio room that we've set up in a lab and think that that's going to be good enough, right? We wanted to say, let's get out into real spaces that, as you know, can be quite quirky, right? So you want to have confidence that you're meeting the expectations of all of your customers.
But of course, the people reading the script had no idea why they were doing it or that Alexa prototypes hidden under cloth were listening. So in addition to the scripted speech, engineers collected a lot of, let's call it, colorful, frustrated language as well. But by 2014, as Brad Stone reports, AMPT had done its work. Amazon had increased its store of speech data by a factor of 10,000.
When it first arrived from Amazon, I didn't know what it was.
The Amazon Echo, enabled with Alexa, launched on November 6th, 2014.
Alexa, how tall is Mount Everest?
Mount Everest's height is 29,029 feet, 8,848 meters.
How can it know so much? It's so small.
It updates using the cloud.
Janet Slifka remembers the moment.
The moment of launch, you don't know what the first feedback is going to be. And of course, first feedback's all over the place. But I remember a couple comments were a little bit like, oh, well, what is that? And why would I want that? You know, that there was a bit of puzzlement that very quickly turned into delight. Like, oh, wait, this is actually awesome.
Amazon sold about 5 million devices in the first 2 years. In 2016, Bezos paid $10 million for a Super Bowl ad featuring football great Dan Marino and actor Alec Baldwin.
Alexa, how many championships has Dan Marino won?
Dan Marino has won 0 championships.
Alexa, how many Oscars has Alec Baldwin won?
Alec Baldwin has won 0...
Alexa, stop. Well played, Marino.
Alexa is one of Amazon's most successful products. But what fundamentally is its purpose? Well, ask Alexa.
I was made to play music, answer questions, and be useful.
Janet Slifka says it's that last attribute that defines how Amazon corporate culture and Jeff Bezos' relentless drive flow into Alexa's development.
I think fundamentally that phrase about be useful, there's so much in that, right? Because it does imply a personalization. Be useful to me as a customer. And that means deliver me the experiences I want with the language I want. Change with me as what useful means for me as a customer. So it might look like a fairly short set of words to be useful, but there's so much in that. And I think that's what we keep striving to deliver.
For example, right after launch in 2014, Bezos instructed the team to develop new, useful Alexa skill sets every week. They pretty much still stick to that 7 years later.
The way that innovation at Amazon thrives, or at least in my experience thrives, is because of the way the leadership principles capture that philosophy, that proven track record of success for fostering innovation. And I think that's so baked in, it's so integral, and that's just the fabric of every day and is a constant part of Amazon, independent of how people shift their focus.
Recall, Janet Slifka is the director of research for Alexa AI. So what does she want Alexa to be able to do next?
Addressing how creative people are with all languages and mixing languages.
It sounds so simple, but human language is incredibly complex. Slifka is describing technology vastly more sophisticated than a directive processing machine. For Alexa to be able to understand how, when, and why people mix languages, the AI will have to understand things like context, culture, cues, innuendo, idiom, and meaning. Huh. Imagine that capability, that power, leveraged across one of the largest corporations on Earth.
We as humanity, as a civilization, as a technological civilization, are still quite a ways away from being able to be as magical and amazing as the Star Trek computer. But I think, I don't know, when is Star Trek? So we still have a couple of centuries. I don't think we'll need that much time, actually.
Well, Brad Stone is still with us. Brad, we talked to Janet Slifka a couple of days ago. And one of the things that most stuck with me is she uses language that's exactly the same as Jeff Bezos uses. Delighting the customer. You heard both of them say magical. They wanted Alexa to be magical. How strong is Jeff Bezos' vision, his personality, his character? How much of that is interwoven into the sort of the very physical sense of what it means to work at Amazon?
I think you've gone and answered the question there. It's very powerful. And the employees, particularly the long-term employees at Amazon, like Janet, they tend to exhibit his mannerisms. They use his vocabulary. They completely inhabit the sacrosanct leadership principles that Amazon posts on its website and all around its offices. It's amazing. In my first book about Amazon, The Everything Store, I use the word Jeff bots. And boy, they didn't like that at all. But it captured something. I was trying to be funny. It captured something true about Amazon employees, which is they tend to feel like they've observed their boss quite carefully.
Well, this is episode 2 of our series, Taking a Look at Amazon. The series is called The Prime Effect. And Brad Stone, his new book is Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire. Brad is helping us understand the founder of Amazon through the story of how they developed the Alexa AI. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the downsides of having such a strong founder at the center of a global corporate empire. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's episode 2 of our series on Amazon. We're calling it The Prime Effect. We're taking a look at how Amazon is changing the way we shop, work, and live. And Brad Stone is back with us. He's been covering the company for years. He's senior executive editor at Bloomberg Technology, out with a brand new book called Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire, terrifically reported. And we're talking today about the story of the development of Alexa AI. Might even be in your home in the Amazon Echo, and what that tells us about how Jeff Bezos works and thinks, what makes him tick. Let's listen to Bezos himself in a 2016 interview saying that there is one thing he sees that connects all of Amazon's seemingly disconnected businesses.
Our number one conviction and idea and philosophy and principle, which is customer obsession as opposed to competitor obsession. And so we are always focused on the customer, working backwards from the customer's needs, developing new skills internally so that we can satisfy what we perceive to be future customer needs.
So Bezos there talking about his well-known obsession with customers. Now listen, this is not going to be a full hour that sounds like, you know, a celebration of an extremely wealthy, creative, and very powerful man. There are downsides to having someone have so much power and corporate leverage. And by the way, they don't always meet customer needs. Here's On Point listener Hayden from Charlotte, North Carolina, describing his relationship with Alexa this way.
She's become an integrated part of my life, and she does seem to make things easier. And I'm sure I'm giving up a certain amount of privacy, but I wonder if, you know, knowingly giving it up is any different than the fact that it was already given up, you know, with other devices listening. I'm not really sure.
The perpetual data privacy question. And here's On Point listener Keith, who says Alexa has quirks he does not like.
So every now and again, Alexa will butt into a conversation that I am having uninvited. So we could be talking about anything, basically. And Alexa will come in and either give us a description or a definition of something that she was never asked about. Creepy.
Creepy indeed. Now, Brad, here's what I want to explore with you for a little bit. And that is, you know, it's looking at those 14 leadership principles that Amazon has, as you told us, everywhere in their offices. One of them is dissent, but let me see if I dissent, but
disagree and commit.
Disagree and commit. That's it. So on the one hand, they're trying to create a corporate culture where people are allowed to disagree. But ultimately, when a decision is made, people have to commit. Right. They have to commit.
Right.
And you write about how there's a downside to that, because lots of people even sometimes in the development of Alexa had some pretty serious misgivings, perhaps even more so, more powerfully so in the development of the Fire Phone. And yet they ultimately had to commit. So is there really room in Amazon for dissent to be heard?
There certainly is supposed to be. I mean, there are principles at Amazon and there's reality. They also talk about customer obsession and not competitor obsession. And yet the story we've been telling here, that Janet Slifka told, was about gathering data so Amazon could catch up to companies like Google and Apple. And when it comes to dissent, yes, it's encouraged. But I think a lot of the stories I'm telling in Amazon Unbound are stories where Jeff Bezos himself had a conviction and employees were supposed to fall in line. And the Fire Phone's a great illustration. Employees actually, they didn't believe in the vision. They bought dog tags that said disagree and commit. They knew this smartphone was going to fail, and it did fail. And Jeff is such a powerful personality, respected but also feared to a great extent and very intimidating, that, you know, it's I think there are often cases where employees aren't willing to challenge him, even when some of his ideas are kind of out there.
Yeah. You know, you have at the beginning of the book a quotation about Thomas Edison, right? And the idea that there are going to be a ton of ideas and you're going to create a culture where a lot of those ideas can be realized. Many of them might be bad, but the good ones are going to be wildly successful. But let's talk about one or two of Bezos's not so good ideas. We have to talk about the single cow burger.
Right. Okay, I'll tell this story. He reads an article in the Washington Post about a hamburger is often made from the meat of 100 or more cows. Not very appetizing. But the article says that to make a single cow burger, the meat from just one cow, it would be difficult and expensive. And those are like magical words to Jeff Bezos. And at the time, he's looking for a way to differentiate Amazon's grocery delivery business. So he not only orders up a single cow burger, but he starts taste testing it and making demands about the fat content of the meat and the quality of the packaging. And you can just imagine the poor manager's life who's in charge of this small project is suddenly a misery. And eventually they do introduce it. I believe it's still for sale on Amazon Fresh. And he'd hear the wealthiest guy in the world is micromanaging the heck out of it. And this is what he does at Amazon.
Wow. This is what he does at Amazon. Okay. So, I mean, sometimes it leads to the one single cow idea. But let's go back to Alexa here for a moment, because that one, it's successful. I mean, the amount of feedback we're getting from listeners about all sorts of ways in which Alexa has insinuated itself into their lives. Byron says, my friend's 6-year-old son asked Alexa to send him a trampoline and his mom didn't find out until the delivery truck showed up. I think that's probably not an uncommon story here. But it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brad, that the development of Alexa shows that Amazon, even as a massive corporation, is still built around this person, this man who is a font of ideas, some bad, some good, who has this will to drive people to see if they can realize that idea within shorter and shorter periods of time. And then success just breeds more demands, right? Like you heard, we talked earlier about how as soon as the Echo was launched and Alexa was launched, then all of a sudden in your book you report, well, Jeff Bezos was like, and now we have to put new skills in every week. But he's also got the money to hire as many people as it takes. Okay, that's all good. It's a form of, let's call it positive hubris. But haven't we seen that same Bezosian hubris backfire? I mean, he's taking that into the world of politics, picking fights with people like Senator Elizabeth Warren on questions of Amazon and antitrust.
He has a very strong conviction that Amazon is on the side of the angels. And you saw it in the last shareholder letter. Probably Jeff Bezos's very last shareholder letter, because he's giving up the CEO spot. And it is this impassioned argument on behalf of Amazon, basically trying to lay out the case that Amazon is positive for society, that it adds more than it extracts. I think it's Bezos kind of contending with his critics, this loud chorus of antagonists who are now saying that Amazon's relationship with its employees is exploitive, who, you know, criticize Amazon's polluting armada of trucks and vans and airplanes, and who believe that the company has too much power. And, you know, Bezos, I mean, the reason he's been so successful is because he doesn't have that gene that might make you or I or most normal people kind of stop and pause before building a kind of massive system that might have so many unintended consequences. He's a builder. He plows forward. And that, you know, Amazon has been a remarkable positive force in many people's lives, but there are also plenty of good reasons to criticize the company. You know, we've listed a couple of them, but certainly the quality, the tenor of work in those fulfillment centers, the reason there's so much attention on it is because it is difficult. And it is one of the major, perhaps one of the sole sources of job growth in the country right now.
Well, so just to be clear, in the book, Amazon Unbound, towards the end, you have screenshots of some of the Twitter fight that right. Amazon PR got into with Senator Warren. You know, what did Bezos direct Amazon PR to be so in your face to Senator Warren?
He's pretty combative. You know, in the old days, he liked to say that he was fine if Amazon was misunderstood. And these days, you find Amazon getting pretty punchy, leaving no criticism out there if they believe that it's wrong. You know, they feel like they can't count on any advocates out there to deliver their case. So they're going to go right to their customers and make the case themselves. And a lot of companies do that now. They've got their Twitter accounts and their websites and their Instagram accounts. And what's also interesting, the corollary, is how Bezos has done that in his personal life. So you see him, you know, Instagram photos of him touring fulfillment centers or even at his ranch in Texas in front of a Blue Origin rocket. He's trying to manage his own image now, because obviously the public perception of all billionaires, and Bezos in particular, hasn't been that favorable lately.
So what does the fact that the company is so strongly built around Bezos, I mean, he's the founder, so obviously, but his vision, his personality, his values, his ideas, to the point where, oh God, the book is full of so many fascinating details, Brad. Like, he's got essentially understudies, right? Get to follow him around for a couple of months at a time. These are senior level people, but in a sense, to like absorb everything that they can about Jeff Bezos, and then they get sent out to other parts of the company to lead there. The TA system, which is just absolutely fascinating. But Bezos is going to step down as CEO this year. And what does that mean for Amazon?
Right. I say in the book that Amazon is scaffolding built around Jeff Bezos's brain. And when you remove that, when you remove the brain, at least as he steps aside, you know, you wonder, does the structure hold up? And he says he's not going anywhere. He's going to become executive chairman. He's going to continue to work on new projects. But then you look at the vast array of other responsibilities he has, including giving away that $200 billion fortune. He's building a super yacht, so he's going to be sailing the high seas. He's got a space company. And you wonder, will he drift away over the next few years? What he would say, what they would argue, is that he's put in place a system of invention and that Amazon can continue without him. But I wonder, because we've told the story here of Alexa, and he's so fundamental to the company's inventiveness, who will replace that? You know, probably we don't have to, we won't see the answer to that in the short term, because as I said, he'll stick around. But in the long term, it's probably the biggest challenge facing Amazon.
But you also ask in the book, does it, in a sense, does it even matter? Because Amazon is so big. There's an economic and corporate momentum that the company has by virtue of its massive size and its, you know, its disparate businesses, which are still linked. I mean, does it really matter if there is some sort of a Bezosian DNA in the corporate culture? Does it matter if he's at the center of it anymore?
I think it does. I mean, the history of companies is like, you know, the rise and fall of empires, and we've seen it again and again. Sears, you know, 20 years ago, we might have been talking about Sears, right? And they rise and fall. I agree the clockwork of Amazon seems to kind of run on its own, and they've got fulfillment centers outside most major cities and trucks, and none of that's going away. But, you know, a lot of these tech companies continue to thrive only when they continue to produce new things. And that'll be the big challenge if Jeff isn't around to conceive them.
Well, I mean, like Apple had to go through that, right? When Steve Jobs died, then they still seem to be doing all right.
Exactly. There's a kind of, I call it like a Tim Cook, Steve Ballmer spectrum. And of course, Steve Ballmer succeeded Bill Gates, and Microsoft went through a couple of very lean years and didn't do much that was new. And Apple's thriving under Tim Cook. So Andy Jassy is the successor to Jeff Bezos, and we'll see where he falls on the Ballmer-Cook spectrum.
Interesting. And Jassy was head of Amazon Web Services, which we're going to dedicate an hour to in our series, because AWS, absolutely fascinating. Well, Brad Stone, senior executive editor at Bloomberg Technology and author of several books about Amazon, including The Everything Store and the brand new Amazon Unbound, Jeff Bezos and the Invention of a Global Empire. Thank you so much, Brad, for coming back to the show and for helping us understand what makes Jeff Bezos tick.
Thank you, Magna.
Well, next in our On Point series about Amazon, again, we're calling it The Prime Effect, we're going to be taking a look at Amazon and its impact on small businesses, specifically the relationship that small businesses have with the world's largest retailer.
My name is Chris Jassy, and I'm the owner of Cardboard Safari.
Cardboard Safari makes laser-cut cardboard animal figures like elephant heads or deer heads for people to hang on the wall. And Chris told us about the struggles he has had with Amazon's ever-changing rules for independent vendors.
We had, you know, a few hundred retail customers, mom and pop kind of retailers that would sell, you know, gift shops, museum shops, you know, zoos, things like that. And that was probably 80% of our business. But in 2014, 2015, we started seeing that sales to those retailers were dropping off. We had a consultant who had said, well, you know, Amazon has taken over online retail. You know, you should really sell on Amazon. You know, we took another look at it and saw that we could sell profitably on Amazon. The pandemic really wiped out almost all of the small retailers that we used to sell to. I mean, they're just gone. They're out of business. So that means we lean much more heavily on Amazon. There weren't a lot of vendors who could comply with their previous set of rules because it was pretty demanding in terms of how quickly you had to ship items. Like if you got an order in at 3 p.m., you had to ship it that same day. There was very little time to turn it around. But we did that, and we did that successfully for years. But with this, you know, you must ship things 7 days a week. Basically, you know, it's undoable. Amazon doesn't need to be as predatory as it is. It could be a nicer company to work with. Would they make less money? They might be slightly less profitable, but I don't think they're hurting for cash at the moment.
That's Chris Jesse, owner of Cardboard Safari in Charlottesville, Virginia, one of the many small business owners who sell products on Amazon. And that is who we want to hear from for our next episode in this series. If you are a small business owner who wants to share your experience selling on Amazon, positive or negative, give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Or you can email us at onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.